Another event on Community Voices today, reflection on the inauguration. Right. A look back to look forward from college students and professors to see how they interpret what is happening in the United States. The UIS Political Science Department and the UIS Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs Office assembled this event. The panel features political science faculty Dr. Matthew Garris and Dr. John Transu, alumnus and Illinois legislative liaison Joe McGee, student government parliamentarian Mackenzie Matthews, and political science and global studies major Francisco Lopez Zavala. Here's moderator and public affairs reporting program graduate student Ben Zielinski.
Dr. Garris, why should students care about the inauguration first off, and then what should we expect during Joe Biden's first 100 days?
This past election cycle, more than ever, shows why we should care about the inauguration, that it's a fundamental part of an elected democracy, that we have a peaceful transfer of power, and unfortunately, we didn't quite have that this election cycle. It's important to show that even when we disagree on policy issues, that as a democracy, we can function, that we can... Again, we didn't have that this time. We can succeed our election defeat to our rival, transfer power peacefully. Other reasons why I think it's important to pay attention to the inauguration is normally the president will talk about some of their goals that they hope to achieve while in office. Sometimes this pertains to policy. We didn't see as much of that this time, mainly due to the fact that Joe Biden's main goal is to handle the coronavirus and put us in a position that hopefully by the summer, fall, we're our lives are a little bit more back to normal. That'll also be what you see in the first 100 days. Last night in the first press briefing, Jen Psaki, President Biden's press secretary, made the remark that coronavirus is the issue that Joe Biden thinks about when he goes to sleep at night, and it's the issue he thinks about when he wakes up every morning. A lot of people share that sentiment. He's already put together a proposal that he would like to see Congress act on relatively quickly. It includes a lot more aid to state and local communities, individuals. It had a direct payment to individuals, I believe, of $1,400. It also would raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. And it's an all-inclusive bill. That's his number one legislative priority. We've already kind of heard some back and forth where the proposal's been kind of criticized from both parties a little bit. The Democratic Party has criticized the policy for not including a $2,000 direct payment, not being generous or not supportive enough. And the Republican Party has kind of criticized the proposal for spending too much money. That one particular bill is something we'll see in the first 100 days, if not sooner. Another major issue, not just with the Biden presidency, but with new presidencies in general, whenever a new party comes into power, you typically see a lot of executive orders or executive actions that are overturning the previous administration's policies. And so when I mean by new administration, new party, I mean, so when a Democrat replaces a Republican or a Republican replaces a Democrat, and sometimes even when they replace members of the same party, yesterday already, Joe Biden signed executive orders to have the U.S. rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. Masks are now mandated on federal properties and in interstate transportation. He also repealed the immigration ban from predominantly Muslim countries. And there's several other policies that we'll see Joe Biden take action on unilaterally through executive orders. And then the final thing I'll point out for the first 100 days is we'll see in the Senate, we'll see the trial of the second Trump impeachment. Part of the reason why the House went ahead with impeachment last week and why they're going to have a trial, even though that Trump's no longer in office. Normally you think of impeachment, or the purpose of impeachment and the corresponding trial is to remove a president from power. Trump's already out of office. He no longer has the power of the presidency. There's really two reasons why this impeachment continued and we'll eventually have the trial is one, to set the precedent of that it's not okay to lie about fair democratic elections. And it's not okay to egg on your supporters to try and overthrow a democratic election. And then second, if President Trump is convicted in the Senate, Congress can then vote to prevent him from ever running for federal office again. The Senate trial is something we'll see. The Senate has to start working on it immediately. It has to take up the impeachment like pretty much immediately. I think today they've had the initial debates on it. Now Minority Leader Mitch McConnell proposed delaying the trial for 2 weeks so that Trump's defense team can kind of get organized in both sides. And while I haven't necessarily heard what Majority Leader Schumer has to say, or in the Democrat Party has to say about this proposal. I think they might be in support of it, because another concern that the Senate has to deal with right now is confirming President Biden's appointments to the cabinet. Even before the inauguration, there was concern about this impeachment trial, whether it would take up so much time that Biden would be in office for several weeks without some of his cabinet secretaries and other political appointees. That's kind of where I see the first 100 days going.
Dr. Tran Su, how do we make sense of everything that has happened politically over the past year? The Black Lives Matter movement that gained traction over the summer, the relatively close and definitely contested election, the insurrection a couple of weeks ago, and now we have the inauguration of a new president. So does this say anything about the direction of our country?
Well, it says a few things. I mean, one, I think there's two vectors of strain that are part of why everything's getting so hyped up. And one, of course, is the pandemic, which kept people inside and has brought scope of government issues, which are the perennial American question, is what should the powers of the state be? Part of the reason why Black Lives Matter caught on so much is that people were paying attention. There were so many videos at a time when people were consuming a lot of media, could really feel it. So, I mean, that has been, of course, an issue that's been bubbling along for quite a while, but it was just so in your face. There's also another backdrop to all this, and I would recommend everybody an article by Ken Owen in UIS's history department that is in the Atlantic, where he talks about periods of minority rule, not in the ethnic racial minority sense, but just numerical. It's been quite a while, and this has come up quite a few times. So we've had the mismatch between votes and representation is really large at the moment. And one of the points that he made is that both parties have done this in one way or another when they have the opportunity, not so much at exactly this way. When the dam breaks, it tends to be quite a bit of backlash. It's been a long time, you know, of close electoral college victories with pretty decent popular vote majorities, and that creates a lot of strain. Part of the reasons why things have come to a head so much is that, you know, there was really, especially over the summer, really broad support for Black Lives Matter. One of the biggest swings in public opinion that we've seen, really. I mean, the last time something that seemed that entrenched moved so quickly, it was probably gay marriage. But with generally those symbolic issues don't move very quickly. There was massive support and focus, and it seemed like there should have been policy change, and the policy change just was not happening. There was a great deal of frustration among what's the Democratic coalition and then people on the left who are not part of the Democratic coalition, that there seemed to be the focus, the numbers, the will, and just very little happened. And then on the other side, there's this sense that it's, you know, that every election is the last chance, right? That this is a rear guard moment. And once they get out, they'll never get back in. And as Dr. Garris was saying, this is one of the things. So the people in comparative politics have been freaking out about this situation for a while, because it's just not good. Part of the reason why we used to have peaceful transitions of power is that you knew that you'd have a chance to get back in, that whoever took over was not going to use the state to block you forever. So everything didn't have to be a last ditch. You could come around and do it again. Just numbers wise, the Republican Party, and particularly the whitest and most traditional parts of it, are looking at, you know, a demographic swing, and then just elections, they're having a harder and harder time pulling it off. That makes it hard to step out. If you look at public opinion, and I mean actually doing surveys and doing random sample surveys, rather than just hearing what people say in social media or on the media, is there's such similarity. And, you know, I think there's a fear that the values aren't shared by the other side, but they really are, much more than people are aware. It's not quite as simple as both sides, but to the degree that that works, both sides believe that the other side is worse than they actually are. I do have to come back, though, that this is what democracies are meant to deal with. And when there isn't policy change in the majority's direction, that's a tense situation. So just one last thing I want to say on this is that it feeds into something you'll hear people say, that now that I have an opportunity to explain it, I'm going to take it. people will say, it's often on the heels of one of these statements about, well, public opinion is pretty strongly in this direction, but our policy is not up with it. And people will say, well, we're a republic, not a democracy, which for political scientists is like, it's just nails on the chalkboard. So the way we hear that is somebody saying it's a beagle, not a dog. If you read the Federalist Papers, yes, they didn't want the straight mob doing stuff instantly, but it was a democratic republic. This idea that that some group could declare themselves the true members of the republic and resist the electorate just because they're more virtuous is not something that that's what the founders were trying to get away from in a lot of ways. We've got some fundamental tension now, how we're going to update our government to be more in sync with where public opinion is going.
Joe, could you just tell us a little bit about your experience working in Washington? Tell us a little bit about what you did, and what do you want regular people and us college students to actually know about the people who work in Congress?
DC is basically a place. So when I got there, I learned very quickly that it's a place that motivates you, and basically you can see firsthand how effective change, like what that looks like on a firsthand level. Working on Congress, you actually get a hand in doing that, whether it's from the staff assistant level or all the way up to the chief of staff level. It's one of those things where you can have your hand in everything from being at a think tank to a lobbying firm to different agencies on Capitol Hill. You can have your hand, you know, at a nonprofit, so you can have your hand in anything. And the best thing about being in DC is that you learn how to communicate, because you can't get anywhere without communicating and making those connections that's going to lead you to future jobs, future positions, or putting other people in position and paying it forward as well. I can particularly speak to my time on Capitol Hill because that's where I did the most work at. One of the things that I want people to know, I guess you say regular people or, you know, average people that's not inside the Beltway, is that if you're planning to go to DC and have an experience there, especially working on Capitol Hill, it's good to know what those positions on Capitol Hill actually entail. I think that's one of the most false narratives, or people have this, you know, notion of what the job is, and when they get there, it's the complete opposite or not even on the spectrum of what they were talking about. And that was me. I went there and I was an intern trying to apply for a legislative assistant position. And I had a mentor who happened to be the state director in North Carolina when I worked on Hillary Clinton's campaign. So he was a chief of staff for G.K. Butterfield. So he basically brought me in, and we literally had like a 2.5 hour meeting where he basically tore up my resume, tore up my cover letter, and we rewrote every single thing, every single line, because I literally had no idea what I was doing. So I had to learn quickly how to adjust. And if I'm going to be applying something, make sure you know what you're applying for. A lot of people also have the notion that these representatives, they're writing their own legislation, they're writing their own tweets, they're doing this. And I'm here to tell you, that's what public service is. That's why there's plenty of jobs, because you as staff are actually doing this work for them. Sometimes when you're a staff assistant, which is the lowest position on there, and I know that position very well, you are a jack of all trades, but you're not seeing the coins coming in for all of the work that you're doing. It's work that you have to want to be doing and that you have a passion to be doing, because you're not making the big bucks for a while. You are seen on the low totem pole for a while, but the experience that you get out of it, the people that you meet, the connections that you make, it will take you far in life. Yeah, when you go there, know what you're getting yourself into and what you want. I'm always open for questions. Coffee is a big thing there. Coffee can mean actually going for a coffee. Coffee can mean going for a bourbon at the Democratic Club or the National Republican Club. Coffee can mean going on a golf outing. So if someone says coffee, don't think, and you don't drink coffee, you're a tea drinker like me, don't think that you have to go down and golf down some coffee, because that's not what that means. That just means, hey, we're going to go do something so that we can talk about how to get you to the next steps on where you're going to be. It's all about connections. And another thing, if you are planning to go out to DC, another thing, and you don't live there, but you have plenty of friends there and things like that, what I knew, because when I was first applying, I wasn't getting any looks, wasn't getting any callbacks. I actually used somebody's address out there. They want to see that somebody's already out there residing. They don't want to have to fly somebody in and, you know, worry about somebody getting there and know somebody within the job. You can cold call on jobs all you want, but it's not like being here in Springfield or being in St. Louis or Chicago. When you're in DC and you're going to be applying somewhere, you better know somebody, you know, that can get your foot at least in the door. Because I've been through the resume process. I've been on the process where my resume was getting submitted, and I didn't know somebody, and I did know somebody, so I know the difference. And I've been on the other side where I've been sorting through resumes and hiring people as well. So I know I make a pile over here. There's piles of people stuff that I don't even look at. And there's piles of people that a donor has called and said, hey, blah, 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 I've given so much, or blah, 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 I did this. My kid's resume better be at the top of that thing. And you have no choice but to put it there. Make sure that you know someone within that facility or that agency or that office that can at least get your resume seen. And then taking it from there, you just have to do the hard work. And DC is not an easy place. It's a dog eat dog world. You will learn how to work. Do not let nobody tell you that it's easy, because it's definitely not. You will be scrounging for money the majority of the time out there. I was going to grad school. I had a part-time job and I was working a full-time job on Capitol Hill. It can be done. You will lose sleep, but again, you have to have a passion to be out there, and you have to have a passion to do this work.
That's a cool story, Joe. Thanks.
Joe McGee, sharing with moderator Ben Selinsky what it's like to start a career in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Reflection on the Inauguration on Community Voices. Looking back to look forward at the impressions of our college community. When we return, can there be unity? Visit nprillinois.org and click on Community Voices to read about or listen on demand to past episodes.
This is Community Voices on NPR Illinois 91.9 UIS.